Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold. Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to the new Your Cases on Hold podcast. I'm Andrew Schoenfeld, Deputy Editor for Evidence and Methods at the Joint Bone and Joint Surgery.
I'm Antonia Chen. I'm Deputy Editor for Adult Reconstruction.
And we appreciate you all taking time out of your day to spend it with us here on Your Cases on Hold podcast. The idea behind this podcast is that in about 30 minutes, less than the time that you're going to take with a sitcom, we're going to discuss all the scientific articles in the issue of JBJS that just came out. We're going to touch on some really important points regarding methodology, clinical application, and at the same time, make it entertaining, intriguing, and informative with some inside scoops in terms of how you can make your research better or insights for clinical application. And we're going to do it all in under 30 minutes, right?
Done.
The idea here is that you can take it with you to the gym, on the commute, or, hence the name of the podcast, when your case is on hold, which, as we know, happens. But we're also going to see here that during certain features of the podcast, when we have an incisive tete-a-tete with intellectual back and forth, one of us may say to the other that that case you're making for that study, it's on hold. So hopefully this resonates with you. It's a new year, which means new research. And we're going to be doing this every 2 weeks for every issue of the journal that comes out. And as we get further along in the series, we're hoping that we'll be able to bring in some colleagues, authors, to get them to contribute, give their insights, and maybe we'll put their cases on hold as well. So the way things work, we have several different featurettes just to kind of orient you. There's the headlines where myself and Antonia will give one article, a short synopsis. This is not journal club type stuff. You know, this study was conducted from the Oxford team and they looked at this many cases over the, no, we're going to give you like real quick and easy, digestible, point out some important factors. And then if it's something that really excites you, something that really invigorates you, then head on over to the JBJS website or, you know, pull out your journal that you received in the mail, open it up and you know, read the article in full. We're each going to give one headline. Then we're going to go into your cases on hold featurette, which is where we really have that intellectual wordsmithery back and forth, each of us, you know, arguing a point. We'll then go into our toss-up section where we'll have several points to discuss. This is also a back and forth, and then we'll finish with our big finish, which is the last three articles. Some important points. This, Your Cases on Hold, is brought to you by the Miller Review Course. Outstanding for all of those who are getting ready to take one of the most important examinations, of course, with the ABOS Part 1. If you haven't signed up, even if you're early on or earlier on in your training, or you're looking for a refresher, it's really good for everybody. So another important point for everyone, this is my opinions and Antonia's opinions. This is not reflective of the official stance of JBJS Board of Trustees or the editorial board or the editor-in-chief of the journal or the editors of the other subsidiary journals. So this is our opinions meant to be. In some cases, the takes are hot and the takes are adversarial just for the sake of entertainment. So without further ado, I think we should get into things. Does that sound good? Anything else you want to add?
I would say I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to razz it up and hopefully this makes your reading of JBJS even more fun.
And take our talking points and turn them into your journal clubs. I mean, we're doing the work for you, right?
You're welcome.
You get entertainment, you get research, you get education, and we're doing the work for you. And don't forget, subscribe and get the notification so that you can get the next one that's coming out so you can know in advance. But just heads up, it'll be the Tuesday before every issue of JBJS. So the first and third Tuesday of the month will be dropping a new podcast. Get on Spotify or Apple or wherever else you get your pie, or get it directly from the JBJS website. It'll be there too. All right. So headlines, my headline article. This is development of a knee arthroplasty episode-based cost measure for evaluating cost in the merit-based incentive payment system. As we know, total joint arthroplasty are anticipated to be an increased proportion of Medicare expenditures in the coming years and in the decades ahead. Episode-based cost measures for use in MIPS are being developed on a number of levels, and this article is written by a CMS contractor. So it's not just academic, introspective stargazing. There's the real potential for this to show up in your practice or to be applied to your practice in the future. So if you want to see what's in the pipeline and you're, you know, concerned about how merit-based payments may work in the future, definitely take a look at this. They present a tool for assessing clinicians' costs of management focused directly on care related to knee arthroplasty as opposed to extraneous and other adjunct measures. It's a really well done article. They present a lot of useful information that I think it will be advantageous to surgeons and definitely something that could be in the pipeline in the not too distant future. So get the heads up now and check this one out. What's your headline, Antonia?
So my headline has a lot less initials in it and are a lot easier to read. Yours is sophisticated beyond sophisticated, but that's who you are, Andrew. That's what I love about you. So mine is simple. Lymphedema is a significant risk factor for failure after primary total hip arthroplasty. Of course, you're singing my language. We're talking about joints, so this is a wonderful thing. But this came out of the group in Mayo, and what I like about it is they probably have a lot of patients with lymphedema. Everything is nice and differently sized, I guess, in the Midwest. So they definitely see patients who have lymphedema, and it's actually something I see in my own patients. So I chose this as my headline article because when patients come in with lymphedema, it's not just their body mass index that's a problem, right? An interesting thing about these patients in this study, their average body mass index was 35, 36, not above our 40 cutoff, but they had lymphedema in the leg that was undergoing surgery. And they matched it 1 to 6, and they found that these patients had increased risk of complications, reoperation for any cause, post-op infections, and they had a less infection-free survival rate, which is not surprising, but it's a higher amount, by 90% versus 98%. So whenever a patient comes with lymphedema, they're like, doc, it's just my leg is a little bit swollen. You're going to make it better. And I'm like, no, no, no. Surgery does not make it better per se. And this is the hip, not the knee. This is the hip. So this is not the area that's the swollen area normally. It's normally distal to that point. So this is what I can take to my patients and say, you have lymphedema. Let's get it treated ahead of time because I'm going to hopefully improve your outcomes after surgery, or at least you'd be able to mitigate the risk beforehand. So this is something I can bring to my practice, something I can use that's very practical. And again, it's not just body mass index, it's actually swelling in the joint itself. So there's treatments for it and we can engage in that.
Yeah, perfect. You know, that's the best thing, the kind of research that you can immediately apply to clinical practice, and it makes your practice better. It makes patient care better. It makes outcomes better. I mean, what more could you ask for? That article is also associated with an infographic. So be sure to check that out as well through jbjs.org when you're accessing that article. Are we ready to get into the case is on hold featurette?
This is the one. This is when it gets a little bit
ahead. This is where we're going to go at it. All right. So the article that we selected for the Your Case is on Hold featurette is the effect of surgical approach and femoral prosthesis type on revision rates following total hip arthroplasty. Let's get your take.
Ooh, we're talking on a controversial topic, anterior versus posterior. So they left out direct lateral, which is my personal favorite, but I understand why. They had a huge volume of surgeons and a huge volume of cases. This is out of Australia. And what's interesting is a lot of the studies that are done when it comes to approaches, I feel, are, you know, a lot of posterior and just a little bit of anterior. Here, you have almost equal amounts of both populations, which is pretty impressive. And it takes, you know, over 40,000, 45,000 actually total hips in the country, obviously, and compared them. And no surprise, I would say, is that there were increased rates of loosening and fracture in the femur when it came to the anterior approach. That's been shown over and over again. But the all-cause difference between the revisions were no different. Anterior, posterior, in the hands of a surgeon who does it regularly, they do both well. So that's a good sign too. What's interesting to me, and this is where it gets a little bit nitty-gritty, is we got to specific implants. And so what they wrote, you know, if you look down here at the hazards ratio, some of these implants are ones that are commonly used and been commonly used for 30 years or more. And yet their infection, their loosening rate or their all-cause revision rate was higher than I anticipate. So I'm a little worried for my practice because I use some of their plants. So I'd like to leave it out there. Like, this is a tough topic, but a good one that they address head on, because a lot of times we try to keep things agnostic. We don't want to do research where it's like we're calling out different implants, but here they did it on a really big scale. So this is one for the books. Andrew, what do you think?
You ready for a hot take on this one? This is my hot take. Ready?
I'll see it.
This is the hot take right here.
Okay.
This is going to show up as a testable item for maintenance certification WBLA. If not next year, then very, very soon. This is what I like to call Kaiser Soze type research. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, enhance your life and go to The Usual Suspects from 1995. So this
That's
Kaiser
my favorite movie, by the way. Favorite.
Oh yes, absolutely. This is why we're on this. This is why we're on the podcast together. It's simple. It's just that simple. This is why. But seriously, like you read this and you're just like, oh, it's a national, you know, joint replacement registry study. It makes total sense. But then all of a sudden it's showing up everywhere. It turns into people are taking note of this on the payer side. They're taking notice on the regulatory side. They're taking notice of this for your maintenance of certification. So it's just, you know, initial read, you're just like, oh, okay, set it aside. Yeah, you know, interesting. Some stuff that I knew, as you said, like some of it intuitive or already discussed out there in the literature, but because it was done with so many patients, and methodologically, I thought it was well done. Just a couple of the points that I thought were where I wouldn't get too comfortable with the assessment. We don't want to start walking around in the Hamptons in the Louis Vuitton Supreme slippers just yet. With the posterior approach, you have 14,000 cases with the CoRail and not nearly as high a number for any of the anterior approaches. Plus, they were very careful to make the point that the anterior approaches, I think, are more commonly performed in their like private setting versus the other procedures may have more trainee involvement and are performed in more public hospitals. A little bit more of a minor point, but they are, you know, pointing to some findings that have a lower bound 95% confidence interval that's just at 1.0. And the p-value is very marginal for that. They had to like go to like so many significant digits. And I know I said I wasn't going to do this sort of Oxford thing, but I mean, I am the methods person.
I was just about to say, you're the guy.
I got to default to type. So those are just some, you know, finer points to be aware of. I do think that this has the potential to be very headline catching on a number of levels going forward. And there's also a commentary for this. So definitely check that as well if you want to see what other people in the field think about this paper as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like taking the registry, you know, they write out a yearly annual report and now they're putting it into a paper and they're calling it out by approach, which is really different because a lot of times I feel like these companies market based on approach. Like this is the anterior hip stem. Rarely do they say it's the posterior hip stem, but it's the anterior hip stem. Well, is it the right thing for that patient? If you're paying money, now you're talking about private sector in Australia, you're paying many more dollar bills than you are in the public sector. Are you getting the right thing? Can you ask for a different implant? Should you be asking for a different implant? I don't know. This is what's controversial about it because, you know, as surgeons, we're wed to our products. We like what we like for a reason. Now I have a reason for every reason, everything that I use. But would this make me think and say, maybe I shouldn't be using that? Or if this is going to loosen or fail in a shorter period of time, should I stop using it? So this will become a potential, as you say, a Kaiser Soze weapon that people are going to come and throw them at people and say, stop doing that. So then this is when you rewind and you go back and you read it again and you read it again because you want to find the secret hidden areas that these are going to come up and pop up and use. So you're right. This is going to be a secret weapon for both sides, unfortunately. I think implant companies will start throwing them at each other and say, well, ours is better than yours. So use ours for the anterior approach. Use ours for the posterior approach. But there's always a grain of salt when it comes to research, right? This is one area, one study, one country. While important, you highlighted a lot of things that you can't just use this and generically said, okay, this implant is bad for this anterior approach or this implant is bad for the posterior approach. You have to be able to break down by nuances. And we encourage other researchers, hey, in your countries, now that all these registries are being formed, you know, the UK, AJR is being formed here, Sweden, all these other ones, aggregate your data, just look at them and actually see if this supports the data that's here. So it's a call to arms for other research as well.
Excellent points. Really great. So There was a little bit of a cases on hold there, but I think overall we're pretty well aligned on this one. I'll promise more controversy in ones to come. But there's still the room, as I said, for some more incisive intellectual tete-a-tete with the toss-up. So the first toss-up, should you use standard decision-making solely in patients with knee osteoarthritis? This is from the Shared Decision-Making article. I'll let you weigh in first.
So I'm a little torn and a little conflicted in this way because these are my colleagues across the pond. Mm-hmm. And my colleagues across the pond looked at these and I actually collaborate them on shared decision-making aids. And I think that everyone should undergo shared decision-making aids, even if it doesn't necessarily make an impact. Now, some of the shared decision-making aids, I will say for full disclosure, start with, is it time for surgery? And right away, my patients go, absolutely not, and throw it away. So it doesn't necessarily mean that shared decision-making is the one that you should be using per se. And it might need to be tailored for your patient population. But if your patient is ready for surgery and they go through it, I think any sort of shared decision, even if you don't make it with an aid, you should have a shared decision-making potential tool or something where you can engage into a patient and be like, this is what's there. These are the options. And do you want to undergo surgery? And that way it leaves it up to you and have a discussion. This study showed that it's good for knee OA, but I think it should be used for everything, not just hip OA, ACL surgery, you know, any sort of surgery throughout the spine surgery, even actually, especially spine surgery, because spine surgery, the outcome is a little bit different.
Gotta have a long discussion for sure.
Oh, 3 hours later, you might be done.
Yes, right.
But you brought up a good point. That's what I worry about these shared decision-making is they take time. They take a lot of time. And how do you logistically build into a practice when you only have so much time to work with patients? So I feel like more and more people are sending shared decision-making aids to help either garner the conversation and the questions that they have. Some surgeons hate it. Some surgeons love it. But I do like it when patients come in with their list of questions and say, let's address this. And I go, you know what? If I can knock them all out and you feel comfortable with the decision that you made, great. If they don't feel comfortable, then we have to set up another time point and we can also discuss it. But that's where this kind of guide helps be a jumping point. So when the patients make a decision, even if bad things happen after surgery, they've made the decision themselves. And we're surgeons, we're independent people. We want to feel like we made the decision, even if it doesn't turn out great, we made the decision to do so. And I think patients like that power in their hands too.
As you probably know, a lot of the research that I do is in decision-making for patients with spinal metastatic disease, which is a really important area where shared decision-making comes into play. So intuitively, I understand the importance of this. The point that for me, where I'm going to put the case for this paper on hold, not your case, I agree with everything you said, but the case of this paper is going on hold, is that this sort of, you know, it's better in this area than in that area. Knee OA, yes. Hip OA, no. Like you said, shared decision-making is universal. I think it's really important. I think it's important for patients and it's important for surgeons too. And the obstacles are the amount of time that it takes to do it, let alone do it well. But this seems like there's a argument being created for the sake of argument. And I don't ever like the sort of, you know, well, I do shared decision-making with you, but because you don't have the condition for which this paper supports doing shared decision-making, we don't need to do it. Like, who would say that to somebody in the office?
Not at all. None for you. No soup for you. No shared decision-making for you.
Exactly. Exactly. I love it. We got Seinfeld in here. We got Kaiser Soze already. I mean, this is not an inducement for people to listen to this podcast.
But
I don't know what it is, right?
It totally is.
But yeah, it's just hard for me to wrap my head around the premise being this area is the area where we've really shown it's important. And in other areas, it's less important. No, maybe other areas it is less effective, but no less important. So I'm going to put that case on hold. Not your case, but that case.
Ooh, it's on hold. All right. Are you going to put this next one on hold? Are you ready?
Next one. Yep.
Cefloxacin and rifampin for knee joint sepsis. Does it go beyond the basic science lab?
Well, I don't think you can ever say anything goes beyond the basic science lab until you show that it goes beyond the basic science lab. This study was really well done. It's a randomized study conducted in pigs. And there's a significant reduction of moxifloxacin in tissues relevant to acute PGA treatment and when it was co-administered with rifampin. So, you know, these are commonly used antibiotics in this clinical setting. I think it's important. It opens the door to further research. I'm not sure that it means that what they're seeing in the idealized environment of this porcine model is necessarily what's reflective in the actual clinical realm. And I think a lot of that the block to translation has to do with the microenvironment of, you know, say the knee joint that's been operated on 3 or 4 times, how much scar tissue and, you know, avascularized tissue is there, because ultimately that's how the antibiotics are going to get there in the first place. Agree? Disagree?
You know, a pig is a pig, and those things, they wall off everything like no one's business, right? So you inspect them and they're just, we're not pigs. I mean, well, okay, that's a whole nother discussion, but we're not those type of animals. How's that? So our body doesn't do that, exactly as you're saying. So, you know, this actually speaks in my mind to the point of potentially intra-articular delivery of antibiotics or some sort of localized delivery, because you're right, systemically, it may not get through. I guess the idea of these two combined together can actually decrease the minimally inhibitory concentration of rifampin, which we know we need to bust biofilms. So if you take that down a notch, that's going to be problematic. So this is just one combination. You know, in theory, you should run all these studies with a billion different combinations. We don't get tuberculosis as much in our life here, right, in the U.S. But in other countries, and if you're listening and from other places and rifampin is used regularly for TB, then that could be something that's problematic when it comes to your treatment. So you can avoid this drug. You can use other drugs as well, too, I'd say. But you're right. We need to see this being translated into the real life scenario to see if it's a problem. Put the catheters in and potentially deliver it if we want to have high intra-articular concentration. So time will tell. You know, it's one of those things where we put it out there and say, I agree with you. We need to see if it's going to be actually holding up in a patient who's had undergone multiple surgeries or septic arthritis multiple times. And then will it work in periprosthetic joint infection when it really walls things off? And the answer is we don't know yet, but it's at least a good start. And I'm glad, you know, JBJS took a jump on this, you know, basic science paper saying, hey, look, there might be a flag for a problem here. So maybe consider something else instead of moxifloxacin with your rifampin. So at least it puts it on the back of our mind to be like, all right, something to think about and maybe shy away from it. And hopefully our ID docs also take into consideration.
Sure, absolutely. And I'll tell you why the case is on hold here. The case is on hold for basic science studies that stop at the benchtop. So there's got to be a step 2 and a step 3 where this is actually demonstrated and translated directly to clinical practice. Otherwise, it's on hold on a number of different levels. All right. So how safe are safe approaches to pediatric supracondylar fractures? This is covering the mini open to medial pinning, the cross pinning construct in pediatric supracondylar humeral fractures. How safe are they really? Pretty safe, right?
At the end of the day, apparently they're safe, you know. This is one of those things where it's a trend study, and I like the idea of it. The only reason it holds me a little bit on hold is because it just shows that we're getting better with time, which is probably not surprising, right?
The more secular trends, always a pitfall, a sand trap in the longitudinal research paradigm.
Right. We're getting better. We're instructing better. We're practicing more. We're doing that. So guess what? We've gotten better. Thankfully, we haven't gotten worse, and thankfully, it hasn't stayed the same. We're avoiding those nerve injuries. We're avoiding problems that we saw in the past. So they're getting better, no surprise. So good to see. Good to see that we are not getting worse. So just keep your training and keep practicing, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, this reminds me of something that one of the attendings from MGH, Fred Mansfield, used to say, which is orthopedic surgeons like to use research for support rather than illumination. And I think this is one of those types of studies that if you're already doing the cross pin approach, it's going to be something to reinforce like your own clinical practice and experience. If you're just using the lateral approach, I don't think this is going to change what you're comfortable with using the lateral technique.
And we're going to add in a little bit more because I'm going to throw in something from Chick Yates, one of my attendings back at Pitt. Mm-hmm. And that quote that you said is like a drunk uses a lamppost.
That's the full thing, but you know, we're trying to keep it PG, right?
So PG is not my nature. I'm gonna get in trouble for that.
But yes, that's the full saying. Exactly. All right, now the big finish.
All right, let's go for it. Ready?
So far, so good. I'm ready.
All right, gonna throw a little spine your way. Yep. Are you excited about magnets for growing rods and early onset scoli?
I am excited. I think that this study was done in a multi-center fashion from a lot of places that are high volume. And these magnetically controlled growing rods, they're good for children. They're good for parents. They're good for the practice. They eliminate inpatient stay. So it's good for the hospital and it's good for payers. It's an all around real win. I think this is the trend in which the research was headed for this kind of study or this kind of work anyway. But when you put the data together head to head, the outcomes, the risks of infection, the cost, they're just overwhelmingly in the camp of the magnetic growing rod. So I hope this will continue to spur more widespread use of this technological advancement. And there's an infographic for this. So if you're interested in checking out the work, again, on jbjs.org, check out the infographic as well. What can we make of trends in bone markers following distal radius fracture in premenopausal women?
So this is an interesting one because I am a premenopausal woman. So I would like to know if there are bone markers that can say, hey, look, you might break your distal radius, be careful. So what was interesting to me is that if you look at aerial bone mineral density and you use DEXA scans, basically looking at cortical bone material strength index, they didn't help determine if you were going to get a distal radius fracture or not. So that's scary to me because in my mind, that's the screening tool. You get a DEXA scan, if you're low osteoporotic, osteopenic, you're likely to get a distal radius fracture. But in premenopausal women, not reliable. The markers, though, they were a little bit all over the place. That's the only downside about it. So this is good initial research. I think we need to refine this over time. But I'm hopeful because markers are the way to go. Take some blood from me, find out if I'm going to be having distal radius fractures. I'm going to start wearing some wrist guards around just to make sure that I don't break my wrists. So they saw that these they looked at a whole bunch of markers. They looked at, and there's a lot of letters in here, right? PIP, CTX, TRAP5B, DKK1, all these different things that harken back to undergrad or medical school when it comes to biochemistry. They basically saw them go up at 6 weeks and then return to baseline at 6 months. And they saw some of these other markers, basically they're, you know, expressed in osteoblasts and they're high in concentration in the periosteum. They would basically like increase, decline, and then remain higher than baseline in patients who did have distal radius fractures. Now, the study is not huge. You know, it's like about 30s in each group, the ones who did get fractures and didn't get fractures. But I'm hopeful by looking at all these different ones, sclerotin, periostin, things like that, that whether or not they can look at the osteoclast versus osteoblast activity and see if we can make the osteoblasts win as opposed to the downtrending of the osteoclast and hopefully come up with a biomarker that'll help with not just distal radius fractures, but even kind of stress fractures of hips. You know, we see marathon runners come in all the time and they're young women who are getting hip fractures. So if we can try to stave it off, maybe these patients should be getting higher doses of vitamin D or calcium beforehand. Maybe they could get, you know, the medications that we're giving to our osteoporotic patients at an earlier phase. Too early to say, but it would be neat to have a serum marker of this as opposed to just imaging markers. And the final one throwing to you, bone marrow aspirate concentrate adjuncts after acetabular labor repair improves outcome. Is this a big deal?
I think it's an interesting study. We know these guys. This is also work done out of Boston. And full disclosure, the senior author is Antonia's protege. But also full disclosure, neither of us were involved in any of the vetting of this work or handling of this work. So there's no concern for behind the scenes manipulations or anything like that. At the same time, it's single center work. It does show outcomes are better with the bone marrow aspirate concentrate, but this is also prone to clustering effects. It's single center, single surgeon practice. So there's an expertise bias. As the rapper Nas says, when you've been at it this long, it's going to look like it's magic. And, you know, these are very experienced clinicians. These are very experienced clinicians. So it is an interesting finding. They graded at level 3. I would say probably more level 4 evidence for this one. And if you're considering applying it to your practice, you got to see how your practice matches up with theirs. So, you know, definitely some questions regarding translational capacity.
There you have it.
So let's just recap here. In the time that you spent with us, we went through, I think it's 9 scientific articles. We covered them in hopefully an entertaining, intriguing, and insightful way. You got Kaiser Soze, you got Seinfeld, you got the rapper Nas, you got Louis Vuitton and Supreme. Now, if there's another orthopedic podcast out there that's giving you all this in under 30 minutes, you got to let me know because I want to be listening to that one too.
I'm in.
Thanks for spending the time with us. And hopefully that case that was on hold is ready to go, but this is still, your case is on hold.
Mic drop.
Check back with us in 2 weeks for the second half of the January JBJS slate.
See you guys soon.